This is an interview with Isaac Hunt Jr. for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm Will Thomas. The date is July 21st, 2015, and we're at Mr. Hunt's home in Washington, D.C. So thank you very much for agreeing to speak
with us. Thank you for coming over.
I'm very pleased to be here. The resume that you sent us was very interesting, so I'm eager to hear about the entirety of your career as well as your time at the SEC.
Okay.
So first of all, could you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how your career got started? I understand you're from Southern Virginia.
I am a native of Danville, Virginia, which is a town or city right on the border of North Carolina. My mother taught her whole 45 years right across the border in North Carolina. We had a farm in North Carolina. I think there was nothing extraordinary about my life, except I never wanted for anything. And then two, I went to college a month after I turned 15.
Yeah, I saw that. I guess that was, you said it was a Ford Foundation program?
Ford Foundation program for early entrance at Fisk, yes.
Okay, and so so you had been, of course, this was in the 1950s that you were in school, so that was still the segregated school system at that time.
Yes.
So tell me then a little bit about what, with only a couple of years of high school behind you.
I was there with a whole group of people who had a couple of years of high school behind them. Mm-hmm. Janetta Betch, who became president of Spelman College. David Levering Lewis, who won two Pulitzer Prizes. And a lot of other people. We all were there with 2 or 3 years of high school. It was ridiculous.
So how did you learn about that program in the first place, and what was the selection process
like? A next-door neighbor who was a Fisk graduate informed my parents of it and said, this might be something you'd like your son to look into. And so we applied and had to go to, I guess, Roanoke, Virginia to take the test. And I hadn't even thought about college. You understand that. Mm-hmm. You're in the 10th grade. You haven't thought about college. Particularly if you're in the 10th grade and you're already a year ahead of your time, what have you thought about college?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I had to do this ridiculous thing of writing an autobiography in the what does a 10th grader know about writing an autobiography? But in any event, we went. And my parents were very supportive, I think. And it was, I thought about this. I don't know what my life would have been like without that experience. I will never know. You know that. But I think it was a decent experience. I was an exchange student. In those days, one of the things colleges did was you had black kids go to white colleges and white kids go to black colleges. And I was the first black kid to go to Denison University in Ohio, which was, I guess, a decent experience.
And you studied, was it mathematics and economics?
I studied mathematics and economics, yes, sir.
What attracted you to those fields?
Well, I always liked mathematics because I like geometry. And economics, I guess because of my father and his interest in business, I think that over time, not when I started out, but over time, knowing how successful Dad had been with absolutely no foundation, I just got attracted to it.
Mm. And then you did a lot of other activities there besides, your resume said. You were, why don't you just tell me about some of the activities?
Well, I was on the debate team,
mm-hmm.
And we debated a team from Oxbridge. You know what Oxbridge is? Which is Oxford and Cambridge. Mm-hmm. I was head of the Men's Senate. I did the photography work for my class yearbook. I was the photographer, editor of that. And I tried to unsuccessfully get an honor code into the university. But, of course, I went to a law school that had the oldest honor code in the country. But I didn't know that at the time when I was trying to get one in. And I played intramural ball, basketball, football. Not football, basketball, tennis. So I had a decent life there.
And at what point did you decide that you wanted to do law school?
I think my father decided that for me. He said, if you don't know what you're going to do with your life, go to law school. So that's what I did.
And you went to the University of Virginia?
Yes.
Okay, what made you decide to go there?
It was my state law school.
Okay.
It was very cheap for an in-state resident. I think my whole law school cost less than one of his years at St. Albans. Hmm. That's how cheap it was. About $300 in tuition a year.
Did you have any idea of what sort of practice you wanted to be in after you left?
Well, I got an offer to go to the SEC mm-hmm. as a staff member, and that sounded somewhat interesting to me, so that's what I did.
Staying with a little bit longer, I guess, at the University of Virginia, they had only just begun to admit black students.
I was the second black graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law.
Could you tell me a little bit about that experience?
Well, I think the law school was probably less segregated than any other part of the university. That is, after you took away UVA graduates, the top graduates came from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. So there was not a lot of racial animosity in my experience in the law school. My best friends in the law school were from Harvard and Princeton and Rutgers. Mm-hmm. And although I saw a lot of segregation in the rest of the university because it was a very segregated place. Mm-hmm. It was also almost all male mm-hmm. at that time. There were no undergraduate females. But in the law school, in terms of the faculty and the student body, I thought it was a pretty open place. And I'm still in contact with some of my friends from the law school. That's over 50 years ago now, but some of them are still friends. So it was, it's a great law school. I've been back a couple of times for programs. I have a former sister-in-law who's on the faculty there. So I'm in contact with the place a lot.
Okay. So were you attracted to corporate law in particular, or did you have any sort of notion before you went to the SEC that that was an area you wanted to get into?
I didn't have any sense of that when I went to the SEC as a staff member, but I got interested after I became a staff member. And I guess I got more interested when I became a law professor.
Okay.
Because I taught contracts law and corporate law and securities regulation and remedies primarily. So the corporate law stuff got interesting to me when I got into teaching. Because, you know, if you're going to teach, you got to know something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to work very hard to know something about teaching corporate and securities law.
So you were at the SEC in the 1960s then?
1960s, yeah.
Yeah, when did you arrive?
1962.
And tell me a little bit about your experience. It was in the division of...
Division of Corporate Finance. I think, as I was thinking about this interview, the SEC was, in those days, filled with a lot of very bright Jewish lawyers who could not get jobs in predominantly WASP law firms. And so the SEC then was just not a discriminatory place. Now, when I've read about younger black lawyers who've had horrible times in other jobs in the federal government, that just was not my experience. I mean, I had wonderful friends at the SEC, still have friends from the SEC, and I think it was because so many of them just thought they could not get jobs, you know, in WASP law firms, to use a horrible word.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, there weren't yet that many black staff members at the SEC.
I was the only black lawyer. When
you were the only one. But at the same time, you say that that wasn't... I mean, did that impact your experience there, or was it just so
well,
I professional?
I had... There was a woman who was the only black female professional who I thought was brilliant, and she didn't go to law school, but she was a financial analyst. And she and I were close friends when I was the only black lawyer. But I guess I just, at the SEC at that time, I didn't feel oppressed at all. I remember going to the March on Washington and thinking, there are all these people here who think they've been oppressed. They have been oppressed. And I'm a lawyer at the SEC, and I don't feel oppressed at all. And I just, you know, I just felt comfortable being there.
Did more black lawyers arrive during your original time?
Not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. Okay.
Not a whole lot.
Could you tell me a little bit about the work that you were doing? Was it reviewing disclosures and that sort
of thing? It was reviewing disclosures in Investment Company Act and Securities Act and Securities and Exchange Act. Because the division in which I worked dealt with investment companies, we had to look at the disclosure documents of all three major disclosure acts, the 33 Act, the 34 Act, and the 40 Act. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at disclosures in all those areas, and proxies in all those areas.
Often when I've heard people talk about their time in that division, they say that really when they arrived, they were pretty much thrown right in and had to learn on the job. Was that your experience?
I had no idea what I was getting into.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know what an investment company was. And they say you're going to be reviewing investment company disclosure documents. So it was learning on the job, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But no, in my memory at least, no harassment, no discrimination, just learn the job, mm-hmm. get the job done.
Do you remember some of the people that you worked with there?
I do. My first boss, whose name I can't remember now, was a a branch director, a tragic person, because he really was an alcoholic, and that destroyed him. Hmm. But there were other brilliant lawyers I worked with, in the disclosure area and in the general counsel's office. Dennis Lair, who's a still friend, Charles Blankford, who's still a friend. They were both lawyers from first-rate law schools. Mm-hmm. The woman I mentioned, Carolyn Lewis, who was a graduate of Hampton University but did not go to law school, although she could have. Fred Cecil, who was a member of what was called the Special Study of the Securities Market, mm-hmm. which you may have heard of in other, and he was not a lawyer, but he came down to work on the Special Study, and he became a very close friend and still is a close friend. So, I remember a lot of people I worked with.
Did you do anything with the Special Study?
I didn't. They were sort of almost in a room by themselves.
Okay.
You know, I knew what they were doing, and I tried to read it when it came out, but I had no idea when they were working. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any idea of how little they knew. One of the people on the Special Study told me, we went to a meeting in New York, and there was a Princeton guy there, and a Princeton guy there, and a Princeton guy there. And the Princeton guy says, what do you want? And the guys didn't have any idea of what they wanted, because they didn't know how much the Princeton guys knew about the markets that they didn't know. So that's they started essentially from ground zero and said, we got a whole lot to learn about how this stuff works. So they did a great job, but they really started out almost from ground zero.
Oftentimes that's kind of the best way to learn about something is from a state of ignorance. But it must have been intimidating to be coming from the SEC and admitting that and then working up
yes,
to understand
it. I think it must have been intimidating for them to say, we're at the SEC and we don't know half of what these guys know sitting in this room, mm-hmm. making all this money at, you know, Merrill Lynch and all the rest of the places, but they didn't know. They didn't know what they were getting in. They didn't know what they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of interaction with the companies that were making their disclosures and so forth?
I did. They came in often. The relationship was usually cordial. I mean, I don't remember having very many fights, but I remember the representative coming in all the time, mm-hmm. and having decent conversations.
So they would actually come in. I mean,
they would come in all the time.
Yeah.
It was nothing for them to be in the building, mm-hmm. talking to us. Yeah, they came in all the time.
Was there a lot of telephone work as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
No internet, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
But a lot of telephone work. No, not a whole lot of facts. Mm-hmm. But a whole lot of telephone work and a whole lot of interactive work when they came into the building.
Okay.
There was also some time when we went out, but it was much more usual, I think, for them to come into the building and talk to us. Mm-hmm. So that was the usual mode of communication, for them to come into the building. Yeah.
Did you have any involvement with things like no action letters, interpretive releases?
Yes, a lot of that.
Yeah.
A lot of no action letters.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, we will not take any action if you mm-hmm. do so and so. Yeah, that was a big deal.
And at that point, they didn't keep like a central file of them or anything like that. I understand that came later in the 70s.
You think so?
I'm not sure. I'm not totally secure
about
that history.
I think we kept a file about no rocks and letters.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we did. Because they were important precedent-setting things. You know, we did a no action on this, so we can do a no action on that.
Okay.
So I think we did keep a...
There was a real effort to try and keep the...
Yeah.
The interaction with corporations coherent and not following the same...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we kept that no action letters. Yeah, that was a... I think that was an important file.
Yeah. So did you have a notion that you were going to stay there, or did you think that you were going to move on? I know that the next place you went was the Kerner Commission, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my law school friends, who was with a New York law firm, came down to work on the Kerner Commission and called me and said, "We need you over here. So come over and join us." And I said, "John, I don't have any..." And his name was John Boswell. He said he was from Chase City, Virginia. His father was from Chase City, Virginia. He was from Upper East Side, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And went to the Putney School. You know where the Putney School is?
No, I don't.
It's in Vermont. It's one of the first co-ed boarding schools in the country. Fairly prestigious. Anyway, John went there. Came to UVA and went to undergraduate school. We became friends when we met in law school. He called me and said, "Come over to the Kerner Commission with us." So I went over. I essentially think that changed my life.
Give us a little background on the Kerner Commission, since a lot of people who will be reading this transcript probably won't know a lot about that history.
Well, it was called the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. It was called the Kerner Commission because the governor, the chair of the commission was Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois, one of the many governors of Illinois who've been to prison, including one of my son's wife's friend worked for. What's his name?
Blagojevich.
Of course.
But they've hit a lot, unfortunately. But anyway, he was the chair. The vice chair was John Lindsay, the mayor of New York City, and I got to know two of his staff members very well. Peter Goldmark, who also is a friend of, whose daughter is a friend of my son, and Jay Kriegel, who were there all the time. So what we did was we went to all the cities that had what was called civil disturbances in the 1960s and interviewed the leaders of the cities and essentially the minority leaders of the minority community. Now, what we typically did was the black people on the team interviewed the black people, the white people on the team interviewed the white. But in one instance that was distinctive to me, I was the captain of the team that went to Atlanta. And my bosses, both Harvard, called me in and said, "You will interview the police chief." Because the police chief of Atlanta was the only police chief on the commission. And they said, "If you're going to Atlanta, you've got to interview him. And you got to take somebody with you to take notes so that there's no discrepancy about what you said and what the chief..." They didn't have any question about Chief Oxford. He was a fine man. Terrific guy. So that's what we did. Except for that interview with the police chief of Atlanta, we almost always divided it up black and white. But we worked very hard back at the office.
Where was the office?
1016 16th Street, right across the street from the Capitol Hilton.
Okay.
And so that's where we worked out of. And we worked very hard. A couple of times, I remember coming in from work at 8 o'clock when my wife was going out to work because we had worked all night. But it was, you know, I thought we did a great job. There are a lot of people who don't know anything about the commission now, and I think that's a real tragedy that people don't know anything about it. Because I thought it was a major piece of work.
How did you feel the commission's work was received? I mean, was it used or was it...
I didn't think it was used. I think Lyndon Johnson wanted it used, but I don't think he had the backing of the country behind him. I think...
And this was in 67, 68.
Yeah, I don't think... I think... I think Lyndon was ahead of his time on race relations. Mm-hmm. I had an interview with, I guess, Roy Wilkins, who was also on the commission. And he said, you know, when Lyndon Johnson was running against John F. Kennedy, I was in favor of Lyndon Johnson. But if you ever tell anybody that, I'll say you're a liar, because nobody will believe that a black man would have chosen Lyndon Johnson over JFK. But Lyndon was stronger and deeper on race relations than JFK or RFK ever were. Mm-hmm. And I've always believed that. Lyndon was... I'm a Southerner. Lyndon was a revived Southerner who had it in his bones that race relations, racial discrimination was just not right. JFK and RFK, I don't think ever seriously had that belief. I think Teddy may have, but I don't think RFK and Robert Kennedy ever did.
You think that just comes from their backgrounds, that Johnson was in a position where he had to confront that more directly?
That's a very interesting question.
Well, Johnson had been a school teacher.
Johnson had been a school teacher. And Johnson had come out of poverty in Texas. And he knew what poverty was like. I mean, where did the Kennedys come from? Right?
Right.
Although two of them went to my law school, so I can't disparage them too much. But Johnson came out of poverty, and there's this great article by a guy who did a book on Lyndon and did this article for the Cosmos Club, of which I'm a member, in which he described Johnson's fanatical work with Franklin Roosevelt to get water to the Texas Hill Country, because he knew if you got electricity and power to the Hill Country, you would change people's lives, because women wouldn't have to haul all these things of laundry every week if they could have electricity and make it work. Anybody who wasn't from there didn't understand that, but Lyndon did. Mm-hmm. And he finally, I guess, FDR said, oh, give him a damn. And they gave him a dam, and so he got electricity and power into Texas. And Johnson just said that, in my view, uh, real sense of what it meant to be poor and to come out of being poor that I don't think a lot of people who didn't come from that background had. So I've always just thought that London was a significant, real significant president.
So coming back to your work on the Kerner Commission, you mentioned that it was a transformative experience for you. Could you tell me more about that?
Well, after the Kerner Commission, I went to New York City to do some work with the Lindsay administration through the through a company on the founded on the West Coast with the Air Force. And we did work in a lot of areas in the city government. And I was assigned to do work on increasing minority recruitment in the New York City Police Department. So I saw a lot of files that other civilians had not seen.
Police files?
Yes. And it drove the policeman crazy. Who is this nigga sitting here looking at our files when no other person, no other civilian has ever been able to see these files? And then these people, Jay Krieger, Peter Goldmark, just said, he will see those files. If he thinks he needs to see those files, he will see those files. And so they gave me the files. The reason I thought it was transforming was because I don't think I would have, one, become a law school professor without that experience on the Kerner Commission, and then the work in New York. And if I hadn't become a law school professor, I would never have become an SEC commissioner.
Mm-hmm. The work in New York, that was, I'm recalling from your resume, was with the Rand Corporation.
Yes,
in
the Rand Corporation.
That didn't last a long time. I happen to know a little bit about that, but... it's New York City
yes.
work, but that was in that period when they were doing that sort of thing.
Yes.
How big of a team? What sort of?
We had a big team. We had a big office on Madison Avenue and 55th mm-hmm. Street. I mean, it was a fairly fancy organization.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I think the work produced that much effort in a long-standing way in the sense of transforming New York City. Although it started out as, you know, we're really going to, with John Lindsay's help, mm-hmm. we're really going to turn this city around. But I don't think we did. I think maybe the work on the minority recruitment helped some.
Mm-hmm.
I think it helped improve minority recruiting because there were a lot of people who came through our questionnaire, which we designed, which indicated that there were a lot of young people who wanted to be policemen but just thought they didn't have any chance to be because the system was rigged against them.
Well, it was a very long process of reform in that department.
Yeah.
Did that work involve doing a lot of interviews like the Kerner Commission one did, or was it more kind of that document-based work you were talking about?
It was a lot of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the heads of the police department were open. They really were. Mm-hmm. To talking to me and to my colleagues. I mean, I'm sure that was... without knowing, without being able to say it. I'm sure there was some disgruntlement about what we were doing. There's some disgruntlement about what the Lindsay administration was trying to do to open up the police department. But by and large, the heads of the... That's what has troubled me so much about the recent incidents with the police, mm-hmm. because when my memory of the New York City Police Department was that they were trying to be fair. And then when I see this stuff in, you know, all these small cities around the country in the last 6 months, it drives me crazy because it's like, what didn't they learn? How do they not know you can't do this? Now, I've not been arrested here, but every incident I've had with police in this city, Washington, which I love, has indicated to me that police, white police, are uninformed, uneducated, and manifestly without judgment. Hmm. Right around the corner, a guy stopped me. Didn't believe I lived here, of course. Said, keep your hands up, because you're making me nervous. I said, MF, arrest me. What are you going to do, shoot me? You know, are you crazy? I'm a 76-year-old guy driving a Mercedes, and you say I'm making you nervous? What is wrong with you? But that's what you have to do to confront people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people won't do it because they are afraid they might get shot. You know, they really are.
Yeah.
That guy in, what was the name of that town in Arkansas or Texas, who pulled out his gun on a couple of kids, he would have shot those kids. He would have shot those kids. He finally resigned after the visual came out. He was a Navy veteran, but he was a maniac. He was out of control. Out of control. And that's what I think about a lot of the policemen who've been in these incidents. How do you shoot a 12-year-old kid 2 seconds after you got out of your car in Cleveland? Tell me how that makes any sense. And he still hasn't been indicted. It's outrageous. Why hasn't he been indicted? We've got the video. We know what happened. Why hasn't he been indicted?
Back when you were working on these issues almost 50 years ago in New York, did you look into things like police training and that sort of thing?
Or we didn't, and we should have. I think, as I've thought about it recently, within the last 6 months. I don't know what the... Is it recruitment? Do you bring in the right people? I don't know that. I really don't know that. Or is it training? Or is it a combination of the two? You bring in... And I don't... You know... In New York City, we had a friend who worked in the busiest fire department in the world, which is in Brooklyn. He went to Howard here, but dropped out, I think. But the firemen and the police essentially come from the same class of people. But I think firemen don't get the prejudice police people have because they don't see the worst of people. You know, they see people in distress, houses are burnt, but they don't see people on the street shooting people. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes all the difference in the world, in the sense of, you don't hear about firemen having problems with dealing with black people, only policemen. But they come from the same class of people, in my view. Provincial, Irish Catholic, from Queens, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. But the firemen don't have any problem. Policemen do. And there's been a lot of talk recently about, is it training or is it selection? And I gotta believe it's a combination of the two. And I don't know how to, I really have no clue as to how you pull that off to get the right combination of people. And I know we don't want policemen shooting people in the back who are running away. I mean, that's absurd. You know, that's really absurd. But I don't know how you get there. That's not something we dealt with when I was working with the police in New York City. And in retrospect, maybe it's something we should have worked on. But I don't know that we had the tools then to know how to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have the tools now to know how to do it. But I know we didn't have the tools then to say, this guy should be a policeman. This guy, keep him away from, if you give him a gun, he'll go crazy. I don't know if we had the tools to know that.
There are a lot of people who ascribe problems to just a failure to change racial attitudes. Now, you refer to the differences between firefighters and police officers. You say at the SEC as far back as the 1960s, you didn't experience that much discrimination.
I didn't.
So what's your take on all that? I mean, you've seen a very long history of racial relations in America in a lot of different contexts. Do you think it's just a general failure to change attitudes, or do you think it's a more technical, if you will, issue than that? Maybe that's a too philosophical question.
No. I think my experience at the SEC, which I said was essentially a Jewish agency at the time, and my experience in law school, which was essentially a WASP law school at the time, upper class law school, gave me a perspective on how things could be okay between people of different races. But I think looking at what's going on today with the police, I think it's a class thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to get around that. My experiences with police here in town, although I say I've never been arrested, I've gotten a couple of tickets, but never been arrested, is that they just are a different class of people from the white people I knew when I was in law school or at the SEC. More provincial, less educated, and I don't know how you change that. Because you're not going to get Ivy League kids, unless you're Donald Graham, to go into the police force. You know, they come from a different class. And then when Donald Graham went in, everybody knew he was Donald Graham. I mean, what are you going to do? He's the son of the guy who owns the Washington Post. How's he going to be treated? He's going to be treated pretty well as a policeman. Even though he's on the street, he's going to be treated pretty well. But, you know, those are not the kids who go into the police force, by and large. You know, they're provincial, relatively uneducated kids, black and white, and this is their way out, to join the police force. And I have no idea as to how to make them, you know, we have this crazy, almost us against them thing about the police. It's the community, and then it's the long blue line, and we oppose one another. Baltimore is The Baltimore situation is a prime example of that. As God knows, Baltimore has a lot of problems. A lot of problems. More than this city has, you know, in terms of the integration of communities and all the rest of it. But, I mean, the dichotomy between the police force and the citizenry of West Baltimore was just striking to me when I saw what was going on in that city. It was like war. You know, it's us against them. We need to bring out all of our stormtroopers and our military weapons because we've got to keep these people at bay. I thought it was awful. And I mean, I hope it's gotten better. They've gotten rid of the police chief who I don't know anything about. I don't know anything about the mayor or the state's attorney there either, who are both black women. Although Cosby knows, I guess, somebody who went to college with the mayor. Mm-hmm.
Just for the recording, you're referring to your son just now.
Yeah.
Cosby.
Yeah. But, you know, we've got to get this sort of we against them sort of thing out of, in my view, the attitude between the police force and the community at large. And I think it's gotten worse since we get the current mayor. I really do. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I think it's gotten worse. In most large cities, and I don't know why that is, because I haven't lived in most. I mean, I've lived here, I've lived in New York, but it's gotten worse, I think. And I don't know why that is. I really don't. But I think it's true. And we got to change that. We just got to change that.
Coming back to your career, I know you worked for a private law firm.
Jones Day.
Yes.
Revis and Pope.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was a great law firm. Centered in Cleveland with a major office here in Washington. Extraordinary lawyers, incredible client base. I mean, we had clients all over the country. So it was a good experience to work there.
What brought you into private law?
I think they were looking...
Was this right after the New York City thing?
No, I think this was after teaching.
Okay. Well, maybe I better let you lead the way because I don't have your resume in front of me.
Right, just wasn't Jones Day after the Pentagon?
Oh, I forgot that.
Oh, well, let's go back then and see if we can go forward in the right order.
Cosby, my resume is up on my desk.
Okay.
Maybe you want to cut that off until he gets the resume.
Okay, we're going again.
Do you want to give that to Will, Dad, or...
He has a copy of it. He just didn't have it with him today. Okay. You look at it and see what
you're
doing.
Sure, let me shuffle through there real quick. Okay. Oh, yes. So that was when you went to Catholic University. So you started teaching then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell me how you got into teaching. What made you decide to do that, and how did you end up at Catholic?
Well,
Bryn Mawr, I see. Yeah.
I met the president of Bryn Mawr at the Aspen Institute, and which was another great experience in my life. And he said, Why don't you come to Bryn Mawr and teach a course in law at our school of social work? I don't know anything about teaching in the school of social work.
Can I go back to the Aspen Institute?
Yeah.
Maybe you should... could you give me a little bit of background?
The Aspen Institute is... the guy who's head of it now wrote an autobiography of the guy who was the founder of Apple.
Okay. Oh, is this Walt Isaacson?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I know him actually a little. Yeah. I don't know him personally, but yeah. I've seen him.
I don't know him at all. But anyway, the Aspen Institute, when it was founded, was an institute founded by a German executive who came here. His name is Walter Papke, and he thought American business executives were essentially uncivilized. So he started this institute out in Aspen. The first guy he brought out was Nobel laureate, who's also a world famous physician and organist, who did leprosy work in Africa, brought him to Aspen, Colorado, to be a musician and a world scholar. And so that founded this place. He founded this place that brought scholars from around the world, essentially for 2 weeks at a time. What you did was, at least in the Winter Executive Institute that I was a part of, you studied great books all morning and you skied all afternoon. Not a bad deal.
Not too bad.
Free food, free ski lifts, free housing.
Was this while you were working on the New York police study? Maybe a little bit after?
I think after, okay. Yeah. I think after, yeah. No, because I was back here. I remember I was back here. I went out there twice. Mm-hmm. I went out first as a resource person, because somebody who worked with me on the Kerner Commission got a job there and said, "Why don't we?" And they said, "We need some black guys out here. We don't have, this is an all-white institution. We need to bring." And so Bruce said, "Well, I've got two friends who work with me on the Kerner Commission. Why don't we bring them out one by one to work at the Aspen Institute?" So Tex Wilson went out first, and then I came up later. And then they brought me back after I'd been a resource fellow to be moderator, which is the head of the, you know, the 2 week session. And so that's when I went out for. And then they had a lot of extra sessions that would bring me out in the summertime often, so I would go out on special sessions. So it was a nice connection for a while.
Okay, and so that's how you got involved with...
I got involved with Bryn Mawr.
With Bryn Mawr.
But in terms of Catholic, the dean of the Catholic University Law School called a friend of mine who was on the Harvard Law faculty named Derek Bell, the first black tenured professor at Harvard Law School, and said, "You know, I want to hire somebody to be on my law faculty. Who do you suggest?" And Derek said, "Call Eichhorn. He's right around the corner from you. Just call him. See if he's interested." And so that's what happened. I was still in New York working with the police department, but he called me and said, "Why don't you come down here and talk to me about teaching at Catholic?" I said, "I don't know anything about teaching law." He said, "Come down, talk to me." And that's how I got into teaching.
And so that's also when you really became involved with securities law, corporate, it says here on your resume, contracts, conflict of laws, remedies, corporations, and securities regulation.
Ridiculous, yeah. I only taught conflicts of laws once, but yeah, that's mm-hmm. how I got really involved in corporate and securities. Yeah.
So, tell me a little bit about teaching at Catholic then. I mean, what?
Well, you know, it was, and I don't, one of my closest friends became dean and built the new law school building. His name was Ralph Rohner. But when I was there, it was not a Catholic law school at all. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of priests who were on the faculty, but there was no doctrinaire thing about this is a Catholic law school and you got to teach Catholic law. It was a law school. It was a law school. And we taught law. And so that's what made it really a good place for me to be.
And then I see it was from there that you went to Jones Day for just a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you were in the Department of the Army for a couple of years, 79 to 81, Principal Deputy General Counsel.
Great job.
Yeah?
Great job. My son used to love to go over there and have hamburgers at the... There's something called the Secretary's Mesh. You have to be a two-star general or above in rank to be a member. And it's like a club. You go every day, and they send you a bill at the end of the month. You know, you don't pay anything. No cash crosses the table. You just pay at the end of the month. And you can have, I guess, breakfast and lunch there. No dinners. But what I thought about that job was, well, as in any profession, you know, there are great people and there are assholes. I thought, and I've talked to a former ambassador about this as well, I thought the real cut in the military was made at the three-star level. That is, if you were just decent, mm-hmm. you could get to two-star. But if you were really good, you could get to three or four-star. And they made the cut. And they knew they were making the cut mm-hmm. at the two-star. If you were an asshole, you didn't get the three or four-star. You just didn't. And so the guys who got the
three... They were pretty good at making that cut.
They were pretty good at making that cut. They were pretty good at making that cut. You can be a fool and be a two-star. You can't be a fool and be a three-star. We will not have that. So, you know, General Vesey, who became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who was a close friend of mine, John Vesey, was an incredible human being. But he would say things like, because he came up through the ranks, and he would, in a meeting, he would say things like, when have any of you been a first artillery observer on the front lines in World War II? Sir, none of us have done that. And you know that. Why do you keep asking us that? Because you know none of the rest of us. And then he would say, okay, then you don't have the experience I have. But he was a terrific guy, absolute terrific guy, terrific general, adored, absolutely adored by I think the whole army. So it was a very interesting job. I had the only experience I had had in the military before that. I had an uncle, my mother's closest brother probably, who was a surgeon at the Tuskegee Air Force Base. Tuskegee had at one time the only veterans hospital run by black doctors. The Tuskegee Institute, founded by Booker T. Washington, and they were both in the same small town. And if you went there and you were Dr. Allen's nephew, the pilots would take you up and give you the plane for 5 or 10 seconds. You know, fuel costs nothing then. So they take me up and take my cousin up, and we fly the plane for a few seconds. That's the only experience I had in the military before. And I was 8 years old. That was the only experience I had until, you know, that principal deputy general counsel of the...
So how did that come up? And just tell me, I guess, briefly about what sorts of things you were working on with the Army.
A lot of personnel stuff. Not stuff like AWOL. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the uniform guys did, the JAG Corps. But serious personnel stuff. Mm-hmm. Who gets promoted, who doesn't, who gets demoted. I guess you have to understand that the Army has more civilian personnel than uniform personnel. And so a lot of stuff that we did was with civilian personnel as opposed to uniform personnel. The other thing we did a lot of was procurement. And I don't think, until this day, that the Army has learned how to do its procurement well. We just don't do it well. Mm-hmm. We waste money. We buy the wrong stuff. Sometimes we buy stuff we don't need. Sometimes we even buy stuff the Army doesn't want because some congressman says, well, you know, there's this plant in my district, mm-hmm. and we gotta have this stuff coming out. It's incredible. And I don't think we still have got it right yet. I really don't. And I think it's a disgrace, and I think it's very hard to get right. There's so many issues there about what you do and what you don't do right in terms of the procurement. But we need a lot of procurement and a lot of personnel. And some crazy espionage, like, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call. This is XYZ in the Berlin embassy, and you're my contact to say if I can do a counterintelligence thing with another embassy here. I don't know who you are. Well, you're on my list, sir, to call if I need authority to do a counter-espionage thing on another embassy in Berlin tonight. So I said, okay, well, you know, let's get the documents and see what my authority is. So every once in a while, that kind of thing would come up.
That's pretty crazy.
Yes, yes, yes.
I suppose we should arrive at your time as an SEC commissioner eventually, but you spend then a lot of the 80s and the first part of the 90s then in academic administration at the Antioch School of Law and then at University of Akron School of Law. What are the highlights there? Did you continue to teach and be involved in that securities and corporate law area while you were dean?
At Antioch, I taught once in a while. Antioch was... a school here in town that had a great idea about doing clinical education, that is, kids doing practical work. But if we had had the Yale Law School student body and the Antioch model, we would have had the greatest law school in the world. but we didn't have the Yale student body. We had essentially disadvantaged kids. And getting them to try to work and study at the same time was a very difficult job. It was an almost impossible task to try to get those kids to do the work and do the study at the same time. They were just not prepared for it. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to get my faculty to recognize, guys, we just can't do this. I mean, I had one of my closest friends there was a Harvard Rhodes Scholar, Harvard Law. I said, Rich, what can we do? He says, there's nothing we can do. These people are ideologues, and they want to do this, and there's no way you're going to get them out of their mindset.
This had been in place before you came in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they essentially didn't want me because I was so much a traditionalist, and they weren't. It was just a different mindset. It was an incredible experience. Akron was a much more traditional law school. I mean, I loved Akron. I loved the people in the city. I loved the city. I think we had a great time there. They were nice to me. They were nice to my wife. They were nice to my son. It was a fine experience. It really was. And so I enjoyed that a lot. I don't think, in retrospect, I don't think I would say I enjoyed Antioch a lot because it was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard. And I think it was an impossible task. I really do. But Akron was fine. Akron was just terrific. And, of course, I left Akron to come to the SEC.
So how did the SEC commissioner position come about? Do you know who it was?
Yeah, I do. My friend I mentioned earlier, Fred Cecil, was working for the New York Stock Exchange. But he had a friend who was working in the Washington office of the New York Stock Exchange. And they said, Arthur Levitt would really like to hire a black commissioner. He would like to hire the guy who testified for Charles Thomas in his, Clarence Thomas, in his confirmation hearing. But the women have said, if you hire that guy, we will be in the street outside the White House, so don't even think about it. Don't even contemplate it, because we will be in the street in your face. So he said, well, I can't do that. I can't have all these feminists against me because I hired some guy who, you know, testified for Thomas. So he was looking around, and Fred Cecil, my friend, said to a guy who was working for the stock exchange, well, why don't you tell him to think about ICON? And the guy said, oh, I remember Ike. He was at the SEC with me on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I give his name to Arthur? That's what happened. Arthur called me and said, come down and we'll talk. I came down from Ohio, I guess, and we talked. We got along, and he decided this is who I'll nominate.
And so at this time, I guess there had only been two, Arthur and then Steve Wollman for a little while on the commission. So it's finally beginning to kind of be fleshed out again, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So did you get the sense that they had been inhibited before your arrival? And then you arrived at the same time as... Norman Johnson.
Yes.
Yes.
Who became a close friend.
Yes.
Although he was a Mormon from Utah. Conservative, but we got to be great friends. And Steve and I got to be friends. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe you've talked to Steve?
Yes, I've talked to Steve.
So we worked together fine. I mean, the SEC is essentially not a partisan organization in my experience. I mean, it is either nonpartisan or bipartisan. It is people try to do the right thing, and you don't have the kind of division you have on the Supreme Court now, like, you know, how five are going to go, you know, how four are going to go. It's not like that. The commission tries to do the right. My view is, the Supreme Court deals with a lot of issues that are of importance to the society, but the SEC essentially deals with more sophisticated legal issues. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we can be more nonpartisan in terms of trying to deal with those sophisticated legal issues. On the Supreme Court, you get this bipolar split about what you think is the right thing for seconds. Should we have non-secular marriage? Should we not? You know, mm-hmm. Very important issues, but not, in my view, in many ways, not as sophisticated as some of the stuff that the SEC dealt with.
You mean at a technical level?
Yes.
Basically,
yes.
All the economics of the issues,
yes.
All the legal interests.
And the stuff about what's going on with the exchanges,
mm-hmm.
How rapidly they are changing, you know, the change in terms of how securities are bought and sold is just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stock exchange goes down for a few hours last week, but that's only 14% of the market in listed stocks anymore, mm-hmm. because there's so many exchanges out there dealing with listed securities. That the fact that the exchange in 1980, 80% of the listed securities were traded on the exchange. Now it's 14-20%.
And when you were there, I mean, that's kind of really right at that inflection point when a lot of the alternative trading venues started getting going, computerized trading. And that
computerized trading, program trading,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff was going on. And the SEC was having a hard time keeping up with the changes that were going on. Hard time keeping up. We didn't have the technical expertise oftentimes that the guys at Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. JP Morgan, because we couldn't pay them, right? And we didn't have the machinery. So they were in many ways outdistancing. I think it's gotten worse, although I know the commission has tried to keep up lately. I don't know how the present chairperson is doing. I really don't. I know her a little bit, but I don't know how she's doing. But it really got hard for us to keep up. There was this guy who did, I mean, I knew those two brothers who did the scam.
Mm-hmm.
What are their names? In New York.
Madoff.
Bernie Madoff.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah. I knew him and his brother. They were in the exchange, mm-hmm. in the commission all the time. Really well respected. Nobody had a clue. Nobody had a clue,
mm-hmm.
as to what they were doing. Everybody thought they were well respected members of the financial securities industry. You know, they would come in the buildings, and my staff member would say, "The Madoff boys are here." Like, everybody knew who the Madoff boys were. Mm-hmm. Nobody had a clue that this was going on. And it was going on right under our eyes. And if we'd had the slightest clue as to how to check on them, we could have caught them in a reasonable inspection. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do it.
From your position as a commissioner, how much influence or how much oversight would you have over things like inspection or the ways that enforcement decided which cases that they were going to start looking
for. Well, you know, I thought we had a lot, especially in enforcement, mm-hmm. because I thought we had very good enforcement people when I was there. And Dick Walker, who was a great, you know, general counsel, I thought. But given what's happened since then, I'm not sure how much real oversight we had. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that I really think that technology outdistanced the commission in terms of how things are traded, I don't think we had a lot of oversight over that either. Unfortunately, I mean, I don't know whether they've caught up or not. I just don't know. But we did get behind.
At this time, Arthur Levitt had his real areas of focus, such as the independence of auditors.
A great idea. A great mm-hmm. idea that a lot of people said you shouldn't be dealing with that, and awfully kept. Arthur and I were very close friends for a while. We split up for reasons I don't quite understand. But when he was going through that independent auditor thing, I was right with him. We have to know that these auditors are independent. There's too much. I'll give you a cut on your fees mm-hmm. if you give me some slack on the stuff that you audit in terms of my books and overlook some stuff. There was too much of that. I guess the classic example, in my view, was the Arthur Anderson office in Houston, which was the biggest, second biggest Arthur Anderson office in the country, the biggest oil and chemical auditing firm in the country. That was their specialty in that office. Nobody in any other office in Arthur Anderson challenged them about what they did. And they let their clients get away with murder. They let their clients get away with murder. And of course the whole office and the whole firm collapsed mm-hmm. in large part because of the Shanigan, the horrible stuff in that Texas office. But you know, every auditing firm has this sort of office of officers that's supposed to say, you can't do that. You can't break that account. Nobody challenged the Texas office of Arthur Anderson. And that's what brought him down.
So you were there to see some of these issues, like the auditor independence questions, also broker-analyst conflicts.
Yes.
And there was interest in them before those issues exploded with Enron and mm-hmm. Elliott Spitzer's investigations, mm-hmm. respectively. Mm-hmm. What was it like to have those things become suddenly extremely prominent issues, to have...
I thought that the auditor independence was a non-issue, that this was so obvious that we've got to have auditor independence that I didn't know how anybody could challenge that. I just thought, how can you argue with me about that? The auditors have to be independent. You know? How can you not have the auditor independence? The broker-dealer conflicts, I thought, was... shadier in the sense that you could argue that on both issues. I just didn't see how you could argue against the auditor independence issue, because you just had to have that for the system to work. Mm-hmm. You know, I know the fee system is crazy. You pay us to do your books, and you're supposed to be in the, you know, that's almost a built-in inherence. How do you change that? I don't know. But there's a built-in... One of the great things about the old Arthur Anderson before it collapsed was that sometimes the founder of the firm would call up the SEC and said, you didn't go far enough. You need to make us do more. There was hardly anybody in the auditing profession who did that any longer. And that was a real loss. That was a real loss. I think we got the auditor independence thing under Arthur. I think we got that right. The broker-dealer thing, I think we still are working on. I think the commission didn't act well in the 2008 financial crisis. Some of the firms should have taken a haircut, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we compensated them full bore. We should not have done that. I just don't think we should have done that. And I don't know why we did it. I really don't know why we did it. I tried to watch that. I was no longer there, but I tried to watch that very carefully, and I just think we blew that.
I was talking, actually, I forgot to mention this before, we were talking that I had talked with David Becker, and we were talking a little bit about...
A friend. Yes.
With, we were talking about Graham Leach Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and particularly the degree to which the bank regulators, and particularly the Fed, were really kind of in the driver's seat of setting policy on these sorts of things, both then and later on in the financial crisis.
I think David's probably right. There was, I don't know whether you've talked to Brooks yet, Brooks, the former woman.
Brooks LeBron?
Yeah.
No, I haven't spoken to her.
Brooksley said, you guys are doing this derivative thing all wrong. And Larry Summers and Arthur Levitt said, Brooks, go to hell. You don't know what you're talking about. Brooks was dead right. Mm-hmm. Dead right. And she couldn't win because these two power mongers said, Brooks doesn't know what the fuck she's talking about. Ignore her.
And that was won. Arthur Levitt's position as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ignore. She doesn't know what she's talking about. And Brooksley was, and she was a friend of mine too. Brooksley was right. Now, I didn't know how right she was.
Did you know her from before? Or?
I knew her. No, I knew her when she was chairman of the
CFTC.
CFTC.
Okay.
I didn't know her before, mm-hmm. but she was fighting with Arthur and with Larry Summers. So she didn't come to me and said, "Will you join me in this fight?" Maybe she should have. Maybe I would. I don't know what I would have done, because with Arthur Levitt, Larry Summers against you, kind of hard. Although I thought Larry Summers was an idiot. We were in Russia together.
You were in Russia with Larry Summers?
Yeah.
Was that part of your dealings with the IOSCO, or was that something else entirely?
It was... a Russian-American joint meeting about financial regulation. And we were there for a week and a half, mm-hmm. something like that. The ambassador was his name was I forgot, but he was a very distinguished ambassador. He had an incredible career. Retired since then. But yeah, we were there together. It was a Russian-American meeting. Big meeting. One of the interesting things was that none of the Russian wives spoke English. Mm-hmm. And they didn't travel with their husbands when the husbands came here. So they stayed home, and they were essentially, you know, sort of provincial women in Russia. So they didn't really know how to deal with us when we came. I guess we didn't know how to deal with them either. But the men were very different, because the men traveled, and they came here, and we dealt with them here, and we dealt with them there. So that was a very interesting. that was an interesting thing to see, that the women were so out of touch with what their husbands were doing. And I don't know why they didn't bring him here, but they didn't. They did not bring them here.
And you were pretty deeply involved with international issues.
Yes, I was.
Could you tell me something about that? Was it primarily through IOSCO that you were...
Mostly through IOSCO. You know, IOSCO was, I guess, founded by the SEC, essentially. And so our international division of our staff was very active with the international staffs of other commissions around the country. Steve, by the way, did. I didn't do South America because Steve, when I got there, Steve already had Latin America, and he did Latin America, Argentina, Chile, all that. I got to a couple of Latin American countries, but he did most of Latin America. I did the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But he did Latin America. It was a lot of it was accounting.
Yeah.
How do you get accounting standards uniform? A lot of it was disclosure. How do you get disclosure, you know, uniform around the world? A lot of it was honesty. What do you do about corruption? Some of the countries in the world simply do not understand. Greece. Do not understand that you got to have honesty. You know, you just can't have people hiding stuff and not doing the right thing. They just don't understand. And that's just a cultural thing that you don't get over in a day. You know, it takes years to get country. Look at Mexico and corruption. It takes years, decades, to get that kind of stuff straightened out. And that's a lot of what we worked on. The accounting, which is, in some ways, you can say easier because it's technical. You know, what are the standards? What do you disclose? But the cultural stuff is really hard. Really hard.
When you said Greece just now, did you mean the nation or did you mean like greasing the wheels?
I mean Greece, the nation.
The nation, yeah. They had issues as well.
One of my closest friends was the head of the Greek commission while I was a commissioner. He has a degree from MIT. His wife was associated with Harvard. His son worked at Wilmer Cutler here after going to Georgetown Law. I never met the son, but I knew the husband very well. And he was at a loss as to how to change Greece. I mean, you know, how do you change? There was a Greece law about paying a tax if you had a swimming pool, and nobody said they had a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. Then they took a helicopter up to Athens, and, you know, all these swimming pools in the ritzier parts of Athens, mm-hmm, that nobody acknowledged. They had. We don't have a swimming pool. You know, we just don't have one. So it's that kind of cultural thing that's really hard. I mean, Greece, there's been a lot of talk about Greece recently, but it's a small country with a small economy. Whether Greece falls or not, it's not going to have a whole lot to do with what happens in America or Germany. We're going to survive, you know. But it's still... The first time I was there, I guess, the ambassador had a dinner for me. I didn't know him at all. But one of the Greek guests at the dinner said, "Mr. Hunt, how do you think you're going to get these people to tell their competitors what's really true in their books? They don't even tell their wives that. It's not going to happen. This is a different culture." Okay. you know, just a different world.
I was reading over some of your speeches, and there were a couple of issues that you mentioned a few times that are a little bit off the beaten trail. One of them was the 35 Act, and I'm kind of curious as to whether you had any pre-existing interest in that or if that landed in your lap. What was your interest in the utility holding companies aspect of?
I thought we'd done our job.
Yeah.
And we need to be out of the business. The Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935 is a formal thing. I thought we had done our job years ago in terms of clearing up the public utility business, and they should just leave us alone and let us do our work, because there were other agencies doing the work dealing with public. The SEC's work, in my view, mm-hmm. was done, and I couldn't get that across.
Was the SEC devoting much?
No, we had. I think the smallest staff division mm-hmm. devoted to it, but I just didn't. I just thought, guys, this is done. Let it go. And then they kept calling us up to testify on the Hill, and I would say, why the hell am I back up here? We don't need this anymore. And they wouldn't let us out. They just wouldn't let us out. It was funny. Now, I think one of the reasons that Dodd-Frank is so cumbersome is because when Ted Kennedy got sick and Dodd took on the health care load as well as the Dodd-Frank financial regulatory, that was just too much for one senator to do. And he couldn't do it all well. And so the Dodd-Frank thing just got out of control in the sense of how big it got, how cumbersome. You know, if you look at the original acts, the 33, the 34, the 35 acts, and what Dodd-Frank is like, it's night and day. You know, this and this. And I think probably Steve would say the same thing, that it makes no sense that this act had to be this cumbersome.
At the time when you were there, there was, towards the end of your time there, there was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is a much leaner, more directed act. Could you tell me a little bit about your experience with that developing? I understand that after Enron, there wasn't necessarily so much push for legislation, but then once you started to get additional scandals, that cohered very, very quickly.
I don't remember a whole lot about that. I do remember cohering very quickly, and that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was a very good thing to do. I think the worst thing that happened, either when I was there or right after I left, was the repeal of the act that divided under
Glass-Steagall?
Yes. Now, Glass is from, E. Carter Glass was a racist from Virginia, from my part of Virginia. Mm-hmm. I think he was from Lynchburg. But a brilliant financier. You know, not only did he do Glass-Steagall, but he also was critically important in putting together the Federal Reserve System, mm-hmm. which people don't remember. So a genius. But Phil Graham, in repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, I think that was a disaster. Mm-hmm. I think that was a real disaster.
This is another one of these things that Leavitt would have been in favor of at the time. What was the discussion on the commission surrounding that?
We didn't have a whole lot of discussion because I don't think we thought we could win it. Mm-hmm. That Phil Graham was going to have his way, and it was going to be repealed. So we didn't have commission hearings about it, I don't think. We didn't have any public discussion of it. because it didn't come to us in the normal way of a commission hearings to say, we're going to have a hearing on whether Glass-Steagall should be repealed. So we didn't have as much play in that as I thought we should have.
The SEC basically just was in a position to react to it, right, to figure out how, right, to regulate, right, the new entities, right, that were created, right, after that.
Right, exactly, exactly. But looking back on it, it was just a horrible thing to do. But Phil Gramm was determined to do it. Mm-hmm. And he was a very important chairman of a committee in those days. And it was hard, I think, for Arthur to get a handle on how he should fight it. I don't think he knew how to fight it. I really don't think he knew how to fight it. Mm-hmm. I haven't talked to him about it in a long time, but I don't think he knew how to fight it.
One of the areas that I know that you had a pivotal role in was Reg FD. It's mentioned in Arthur Levitt's book, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about your experience with that. I know the rule underwent some modification, particularly in relation to concerns that you may have had about it, but I'm wondering if you can tell me your perspective on it.
Essentially, I had a staff member who said, I think we can make this area of disclosure better. I said, okay, give me some ideas. And so we worked on some ideas. We ran them by Steve. We ran them by Arthur. We ran them by Laura. Mm-hmm. Have you met, have you talked to Laura?
One of my colleagues has talked to,
okay,
Laura Unger, yeah.
Okay. And we kept trying to refine. And then Arthur came to me and said, I'm going on vacation, and anything you and your staff come up with, I'll agree to. I said, okay. Then when you get back, we'll have a draft to put before. And that's what we did. We kept working on it. I think Steve had some input in it. I don't think Laura had a whole lot to do with it. I think Steve was more sensitive to that area than Laura was. So when we came back, when Arthur came back, we said, okay, here's the deal. This is what we want. And Becker was one of the people. Becker came to me and said, we want to thank you for what you did on getting Regulus and FD passed, and so we want to acknowledge you in the commission meeting. I said, you don't need to do that because Arthur's going to do that. And they said, yeah, we know Arthur's going to do that, but we want to do it too. Okay. So they both said, you know, Commissioner Hunt was and his staff were instrumental in getting Regulation FD. We thought it was important regulation, yeah.
You were kind of on the fence about it, given what was going to go in and what wasn't going to go into the final regulation. What a lot of the concerns were that it would be used in too draconian of a way.
I think there was a feeling that you're using a sledgehammer to fix a nail, and you don't need to do that. And that's what we had to be careful about, to make sure that we weren't overly regulating something that didn't need to be overly regulated. And so I think after somebody said that to me, my staff and I think were very careful to say, we're going to try to do this right and to keep it as narrow as possible, to control as much as we need to, but not make it this huge thing that's bigger than it needs to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what we tried to do.
And in his book, Arthur Levitt says that for the final vote on this, he wasn't sure which way you were going to go.
He's a liar. He knew where I was going to be.
Yeah.
He knew where I was going to
come out. He was being dramatic about
that. Yeah. He knew where I was going to come out on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've read that passage in his book. And I said, Arthur, what are you talking about? You knew how I was going to come out.
Yeah. So when you were sick that day, it wasn't a diplomatic way of abstaining or anything like that.
No. Okay. I don't even know why you put that in the book, because I really, in all honesty, I don't think there was anybody in the building who didn't know how I was going to come out on that issue.
That's a very...
So I don't know why Arthur put that in his book.
That's a useful point of clarification. Another one of these, I know you had a big speech about the aircraft carrier, and I'm wondering if you could give me a little bit of the background on exactly what was going on there. I guess that was Brian Lane's big attempt to reform disclosure. Do you have much memory of that?
I don't. I remember Brian very well. Yeah. What's he doing now?
I don't know.
I think he's practicing, but I'm not sure where. No, I just thought, as I recall, and I really have very little recollection of this, but I just thought Brian was trying to do too much too quickly.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus.
Brian, you can't do this overnight. And I think a lot of us just thought, you just can't do this. You've got so much precedent. You've got all these cases. Brian, you can't turn this around overnight. And that's what we fought him on. That, you know, he thought, I can do this. And we didn't think he could. I think Steve felt the same way. Mm-hmm. You can't do this, Brian, overnight. And so we fought him on it.
So it was just one of those things that was really his initiative and that they allowed him to go through with the release and all of that. But then once that happened, it was pretty much dead in the water.
It was dead in the water. Brian, we're not going to do this. You know, and I went to him, and I think Steve did too, and said, you're not going to do this. You're not going to get this through this commission. As long as we're here, this ain't going to happen. And Brian was stubborn and very hardworking and determined to get his way. But, you know, we finally, we're the goddamn commission, Brian. This ain't going to happen on our watch. So that was funny. That was funny because he really did think he was going to get his way. He really did think he was, but he didn't. He obviously didn't.
This may be a footnote, but it's one of the things that I noticed in more than one of your speeches was concern over liability concerning Form U-5, the dismissal of lawyers.
Yes, yes. That was a... Cosby, would you get me out of the tissue? There was a guy in New York... or either with one of the regulatory private agencies here, who was determined to change the Form U-5 so that there was unbridled lack of liability in the form of lawyers. And the first time this guy mentioned it to me, he was with an agency here in town that was a lobbying firm for lawyers in the agency. And the first time he mentioned it to me, I said, you're not going to get this by me. You're just not going to get this by me. Do you understand that? And Arthur was sitting right there. And Arthur was not a lawyer. He didn't care, I don't think, about that. I said, this ain't going to happen while I'm here. Now, you can try what you want, but it's not going to happen. And so I fought that all the way. I just, they kept saying, we want, sort of unfettered freedom for law. It's not going to happen, guys. It's just not going to happen. I'm not going to let you do this. Lawyers are going to have some kind of liability here. And they...
Do they have support from other commissioners for this?
I don't think so. I don't think they had Steve's support. I mean, Steve's, a brilliant lawyer. I don't know where they thought they were getting their support from. I mean, they knew from the first day they didn't have mine. I think they knew they didn't have Steve's. I think they thought Arthur was non-committal. Arthur didn't care, they thought. It could go either way. But, you know, the two lawyers, Steve Waldman and I, kind of saying, this ain't going to happen, right? Guys, this ain't going to happen. And they wouldn't accept that. And I don't know why. But, you know, in the end of the day, we didn't give them their way. We didn't give them their way. And that was a good fight. I mean, I was... That was almost like from day one, this is a stupid idea and I'm not going to let you get away with this. So end of discussion. This is not going to happen.
I'm wondering if we can come out to the relations among the commissioners in general. And one of the first things I want to ask you about, you told me a little bit about Norman Johnson.
Yeah.
Of course, we'll never have oral histories with Commissioner Johnson or with Paul Casey. And so I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about them.
Yes. Norm Johnson and I became close friends. And he would often, not always, but often say, and this is why I say the commission is nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. Norm is a Mormon from Utah, for God's sake. He would often say, Ike, I think your reasoning on this is fine, and I'm going to go with you on this issue. I mean, these are technical, you know, technical securities. Right? See, I like your reasoning on this, so I'm going to go along with you. And he became a friend. And he was a securities lawyer, and a distinguished securities lawyer from Utah, and a good friend of Orrin Hatch. In fact, the first day he was in town, he had me go with him to do an errand for Orrin. And I'm thinking, why the fuck am I doing an errand for Orrin Hatch, who I can't stand? But it was because Norman asked me. We went out to Georgetown to pick up something for Orrin Hatch. Paul was very close to the Clintons. As you probably know, Paul came from a Hughes family. And as Hillary used to say, every time I see Paul at a White House reception, he's got another one of his cousins with him. So they were very fond of him. They put him on the... He didn't know a thing about securities. I think he was a person of good judgment. He said to me one time, I want to get this done, but I want you to get it, take the lead, because they are afraid of you more than they are afraid of me. Now, we were agreed on the issue. I said, yeah, it's not a big deal. I think it was something about one of his staff members. I said, yeah, I'll take the lead on it, because I totally agree with you. And he was a person of good judgment, of great good humor, and obviously died too young. Obviously died too young. I mean, as I think Clarence Thomas should never have been appointed to the Supreme Court, I think Paul Casey should never have been appointed to the SEC, because I think neither of them were qualified for those jobs.
Basically because he was... in the Clinton circle that he was part of. What was, from your perspective, the Clinton administration's interest in the SEC in general? I mean, I've heard generally that it wasn't actually that much.
It wasn't that much.
Yeah.
It wasn't that much at all. They left us alone. Mm-hmm. To their credit, they didn't interfere. They did not interfere. So I don't know what kind of calls went from the White House to Arthur's office. I have no idea. Or to the chairman after Arthur, who's also a friend.
Harvey Pitt?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who lives, 10 minutes down the street in Kalorama. Do you know where Kalorama is?
Yes.
Yeah. right near the French Chancery.
Right.
Beautiful building there, right around the corner from there. I know Harvey got in trouble because of the faux pas he made about trying to make the embassy, the SEC, have cabinet status. Everybody thought he was trying to make more money for himself, which was absurd, because if he wanted to make more money for himself, he would have stayed. He just started to give the agency more status. He wasn't trying to get more money for himself.
That's interesting. I haven't actually heard a lot about that. I've spoken to a lot of people in this series of interviews about kind of that early 2000s period in the SEC's history, and I haven't heard too much about Harvey Pitt the cabinet status question.
I think Harvey wanted to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Worked very hard at doing a good job. We did some things that I thought were overly... He wanted to have more open meetings that I thought were necessary, because there are some rudimentary things that you really can do by just signing your name onto a piece of paper. You don't have to get the whole commission together to pass some really rudimentary things. Harvey wanted everything to go to a meeting. I thought that was a waste of time. But I think he wanted to do a good job. But I think he was sometimes politically had a deaf ear. Because he just didn't pick up the vibes about, Harvey, you can't do this. You know, you can't say you want the commission to have the same status as the Department of Defense. That just is not going to work. And he didn't do it because he wanted more money for himself. He just started to give the commission more clout. So I think he was wrong, but I don't think he did it out of any kind of selfish motive, really, at all. Not at all. So and I like him. I still like him. And we got along fine. We still see each other for lunch once in a while. So we got along fine.
Tell me a little bit about that period surrounding Enron and the big scandals and of that era. What was the, aside from the obvious enforcement actions, what was the SEC thinking it should be doing in that environment?
I think we thought that the enforcement actions were the things we should have been doing, and that we should maybe we should have done more. I don't know what, but I think we thought that we were doing the right things in terms of bringing the enforcement actions against Enron, and you know, and Arthur Anderson crashed, as you know. Mm-hmm. So I think we thought we were doing the right thing. I do. I hope we were doing the right thing. I don't think we were... I know we weren't intentionally not doing something that we thought was the right thing to do. So I think we thought the enforcement actions were the right thing.
Given the 30-year space between your different times at the SEC, I'm wondering if you can comment in general on the change in the agency in general and about seeing the agency from, you know, those two different levels, you know, one at the very, you know, ground level of reviewing.
Below ground.
Down in the subterranean parking garage. Right. And then being at the top level. If ever you thought that, you know, your prior experience there influenced your thinking as a commissioner.
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think I always remember what it was like to be a staff person below subterranean level and how I wanted to be treated, and I tried to never embarrass a staff member. I mean, if they were wrong, I would tell them, or if I thought they were wrong, but never embarrass, never go out of my way to humiliate any staff member. That was just, you know, that wasn't something I did. I just didn't do that. The other thing, of course, was the staff got incredibly more diverse, male, female, black, white, Hispanic, during the time when I was there as a staff member and the time when I was there as a... I had more, I think, staff members on my media staff who were women than male. Mm-hmm. Now, that would have been unheard of when I was there as a staff member. I mean, it just wouldn't have happened. There weren't enough female there to have that many females on your individual staff level. So that was a big change. That was a big... One of my closest staff members is from Charleston and is the relative of Strom Thurmond's second wife. She is going crazy about this stuff that happened in Charleston last week.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Will, can you move your car? I gotta go back.
Oh, I'm really sorry. Yeah, let me do that. Okay, where were we?
We were talking about the change in the staff. I was telling you about the diversity. Big change since I was there as a staffer.
Did you ever find, you said that Arthur Levitt had wanted to bring a black person on as commissioner. Did you ever find that race was relevant?
No. Arthur and I, as I said, we're very close for a long time. We're not now, but I will never disparage what I thought was his incredible job as the chairman of the commission. I thought he did a wonderful job. I thought he was fair. He and I mostly agreed on issues, but even with people with whom he disagreed, I mean, I don't think he liked Steve very much. Mm-hmm. But he never treated Steve unfairly. I don't think Steve would even say that. I mean, he's a very complicated guy. He's very politically ambitious. I think that's why he and I fell out, because he was trying to stay in favor with some senators who wanted to appoint somebody else. Although he wrote me incredible letters of recommendation for a reappointment. I mean, in unbelievable letters. I don't have copies of them because he just showed me copies of what he sent to people like the chairman of the Democratic, the majority leader.
Oh, okay.
At the time, from Dakotas.
Daschle.
Yes, Daschle. I mean, incredible letters. Although Daschle wanted to appoint somebody else. But Arthur wrote these incredible letters saying, you got to reappoint Ike. You know, he knows the market. He knows what he's doing. You got to reappoint him.
On that question, did you intend to go in for another full term, or were you just kind of, because I know that the commission was thinning out again towards the end of your time there. What was the story there?
Well, two stories, I guess. I really would have liked to have gone on the accounting board.
The PCAOB?
Yeah, because I really thought I had knew something about that. I'd worked on it for years, and I really thought I could bring something to the board. I really did. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I just really thought that I could bring something to the board and add some value to the board's consideration of the issues they were dealing. I hadn't thought about going back on the commission. I thought that maybe I would be reappointed, but I hadn't really given it a whole lot of thought. Because Arthur had written all these incredible letters of recommendation, but then he ran up against Daschle and others who said, well, you know, we want to appoint somebody different. So I said, well, you know, I've had a great time here. I think I've done a good job here. If they were to appoint somebody else and they have the appointing power, I mean, well, you know, and I had a lot of people who went up to the Hill to say, you got to get Commissioner Hunt reappointed. So I didn't have any, I didn't know why Arthur turned on me, but aside from that, I didn't have any real problems about the fact that they appointed somebody else. Because mm-hmm. I'd had a good run. I mean, I'd had all this goddamn international experience that I never thought I'd have in my life. So I'd had a great time. I'd had great staff members who are still friends. So I thought I'd had a great time. So I still don't have any regrets.
So when you were reappointed, but it was kind of understood that when they found another commissioner that you would then step down? Was that how?
No, it was an interim appointment.
It was an interim
appointment. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I was appointed. I've got two certificates, but one's an interim appointment. Yeah. Yeah. So I have no regrets. It was a wonderful job. I had great experiences, so it was fun.
Okay. I wanted to ask a little bit about the period under Harvey Pitt. First of all, just if you could sketch out the stylistic differences between Arthur Levitt and Harvey Pitt. Harvey Pitt had spent his entire career in securities law. Levitt had been in the securities industry. But also the Bush administration, if there was any difference in their views towards the SEC from the Clinton administration, which was more hands-off. Of course, it's that period of scandal, so it's difficult to compare apples to oranges, but...
I think they tried to keep a closer handle on Harvey than the Clinton administration ever tried to keep on Arthur, because I just thought the Clinton administration didn't care about what Arthur was doing. They thought the commission was running well, that Arthur was honest and competent, and I don't think President Clinton sort of gave a shit about what Arthur was doing. Whereas with all the scandals going on, when Harvey came in, the White House had to be concerned. Now, how much influence they had over what I considered his tenure about some part, I don't know. I have no idea about that. He was always nice to me. He sends me a Christmas gift every year. I don't always send him one. He's a terrific human being. But I think they may have kept him closer to the vest than the Clinton administration ever kept. Because, as you know, the scandals were going on. Mm-hmm. There were no scandals going on when we were there. Things at the commission seemed to be working well. Then you get Enron and all the rest of it, and it looks like, you know, we got to pay more attention to this place. And I think Harvey was sensitive to it, and Harvey was also aware that he might get fired because they weren't happy with the way he had handled some things. So he was totally aware that they may replace him. I think that was unfortunate, but I think he was aware of it.
Of course, in the wake of the scandals, the question is what is going to be the regulatory response. But of course, the inclination of the Bush administration would be more in general to be deregulatory. And you maybe see that with some of the appointments throughout, if you follow the entirety of the administration. Of course, you weren't there. But I'm wondering if there was any sense of those competing priorities coming either from the administration or from the Hill.
I think there was a sense that it was going to be more deregulatory, that the Bush administration was simply going to be more deregulatory than the previous administration had been. That was a given. That's who they were. Right?
Right.
You know, that's who they were. So we knew that. We just knew that. Just like you knew that, you know, the Obama administration was going to be different from the Bush administration. Different bodies, different people. They're going to act differently. And if you don't know that, then you're stupid. I mean, that's the way it's going to be. So that was my view. Mm-hmm. It's a different group of people. They have a different attitude. I mean, one of the people, because I'd been in the Pentagon, I kept a lot with defense stuff, you know, even when I was at the commission. I tried to keep up with what was going on. You know, I couldn't stand Dick Cheney. I think he didn't know a goddamn thing about what he was talking about. You know, Iraq, Iran, I thought he didn't know what he was talking about. And I thought I knew something about that area of the world, because I had thought about it some when I was in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And I just thought he was just, God, they're gonna welcome up with roses and their rifles? He was crazy. He was crazy. And I think the world has proven me right and him wrong. You know, I don't worry about that. Dick Cheney, you were an asshole. You know, And you still are. So that was my view about that. I just thought they were just dead wrong.
Right.
I just thought they were dead wrong. And I didn't come at this, as you know, from ignorance. I came at it from some sense of knowledge about what was going on in that building across the river. And the people in that building across the river. I know the guy who planned the aborted supposed rescue of the captives in Tehran. I knew the guy who was in the basement planning that. Everybody in the secretary's mess knew who the guy was who was planning that raid. And we all were there in the mess the day it flew up, and we all knew who was to blame. Sorry, but we knew who it was, you know. Now, could it have been handled better? I guess so. I mean, who knows when the dust storm's going to come up, but we knew who it was. We knew who the guy was who was planning it. The Pentagon, as I said, is full of assholes and great people, and they make the cut at the two-star level.
So I don't think I have anything else to ask about the SEC, but if there's something we haven't covered, please feel free to bring it up.
We talked about it, actually. My principal domestic concern today is what do we do about the rift between the police and the civilians? Mm-hmm. I don't understand how it's gotten so bad. And I think it needs to be. And I don't know, as I said to you, I don't know what the solution is. Do you select better, or do you train better, or do you do both? I just don't know. I wish I did. And I don't think it's a matter of race. I don't think it's a matter of living in the community, or I think that could help. But when some little redneck peasant stops me around the corner from this building, this is a house he'll never live in his life. What the fuck is he doing? You know? In the middle of an afternoon like this? Okay, you want to give me a ticket? Run a stop sign? You don't need to, because I didn't endanger a single person. But if you want to give me a ticket, fine. But don't tell me to keep my hands up where you can see because I'm making you nervous. That's just asinine. Just asinine. And they can't stand it when you tell them that. The other thing I'm concerned about now is I don't know really what's going on in the Middle East, and I can't figure it out. I mean, around Iraq, what is our real purpose there? Because we're spending an awful lot of money. To what end? To what end? And I don't know. And I don't think the president knows. I think Kerry is coming close to knowing, because I think he's been trying to be a pretty good Secretary of State. But I don't think Obama knows what the end game is. And if your president doesn't know what the end game is, I think it's hard for the administration to know what the end game is. And so that's my real concern. I guess my other concern is, and my son would hate it if he heard me say it, I don't think we should kowtow to Israel. I mean, I just don't believe in that at all. And I think we do that a lot. And I think Netanyahu knows that, and he plays it up for all it's worth when he goes to the Hill and speaks without the president's invitation. I mean, that, I can't imagine a... That's a pretty good embarrassment to your biggest supporter when you go to the Hill and speak without his invitation. But the invitation of Bomer from where? Cincinnati? So those are my two issues, foreign affairs. My issue on civilian is that whole problem with... the civilian police thing, and I'm not sure that the commissioner's got a handle on what to do with Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. I know it's coming, I know it's a huge bill, but I'm not sure they have a handle on how they're going to deal with it over the long term. And it may be a long-term problem, you know, to get a handle on that bill. But I haven't had a sense that they've got it in hand.
Are you thinking in terms of rulemaking or in terms of just the adequacy of the bill and its provisions? Both, perhaps.
Both, I think.
Yeah.
I think both. Yeah. I don't have a sense that the rulemaking has been adequate, and I don't have a sense that they've really got a handle on where the bill is and where we, the commission, ought to be taking it. So it's both. Yeah.
So after you left the commission, did you, I don't know anything about, did you retire or did you?
I did some work for the Philadelphia Stock Exchange for a while, both on their board and then as the ethical consultant to the board and staff for a while. So I did that. I didn't go back on some of the boards I've been on before. Unfortunately. So that's mostly what I did.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that we've been speaking for about 2 hours. You've been very generous with your time. Again, if there's anything else you'd like to add.
No, it's fine. I was glad to have you here. I'm glad we were able to finally make it. And if there's any follow-up, once you got your notes together that you need, you know, just feel free to call.
All right, will do. I appreciate it very much.
When did you speak to Steve?
That was a couple months ago. Do you mind if I turn this off?
No, all right. That's fine.